You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today for an author chat with Allison King about her debut novel, The Phoenix Pencil Company. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by you, our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as a Patreon supporter, you can get access to our members-only Discord server. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the ability to help us choose a book club pick once per quarter.
Yeah, so we had a fun chat with Allison about her debut novel, The Phoenix Pencil Company, like what her writing process was like when she was going through a very well-known fellowship, how she came up with the rules of magic in her historical magical world, how she blended genres, and just also her personal history as a as someone who is part of the Taiwanese diaspora. And I hope you guys enjoy this talk.
Yeah, so without further ado, please enjoy our author chat with Allison King.
And we are here with Allison King, writer and software engineer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Her short stories have appeared in Fantasy Magazine, Diabolical Plots, and many others. And she is here to talk about her debut novel, The Phoenix Pencil Company. Welcome to the show, Allison.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So usually we start our conversations with some kind of icebreaker. And this is a little bit different because it's just me asking a question rather than Googling the answer. But so your characters in your book, they eat lion's head meatballs as like as like a favorite snack of theirs, as like a it's like a recurring meal. And I'm just curious, like, what is it?
Oh, it's only the best thing ever.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it sounds like Marvin's had it before, but it's a Shanghainese dish that it's basically a large pork meatball that is braised in soy sauce, sugar, and often cooked with some sort of vegetable. So in my family, we always used Napa cabbage, but I think I've seen it more often in restaurants with bok choy.
Yeah, like my family's from around the same region. We're from Ningbo, which is a little bit east of Shanghai, but like the reason it's called lion's head or suzuto is because it's so big, it looks like a lion's mane. That's why it's called lion's head.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's something that my grandmother made a lot for me growing up. And also that it's actually the dish that she taught my mother when my mother got married as like a wedding gift of sorts. So,
yeah.
So I've been passed down.
I think the key to a good like lion's head is also the texture, because it's like it's really soft. Like you wouldn't like you think of meatball, you think of like the Italian meatball, which is kind of more like, you know, like
a little denser,
grainy, denser. Yeah. But like the lion's head meatball, just very like it's a very soft texture. Like you just like it just melts. So good.
It's like a like a cloud, like almost.
Every time it came up in the story, I'm just like, what is this? I really want to eat it. Everyone is like hyping up these meatballs.
Yeah, I'm sure you can find some in the LA area.
So as I mentioned, like in your bio, you're a software engineer, and that is very different from creative fiction writing. So I'm like curious, like, were you always into writing, or was it something that like came later and, you know, connected you to like your STEM field?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was writing since a pretty young age. I started off writing fan fiction with my friends and my cousin, and we would just be doing that for like most of our summers. But then started trying to write my own stuff like in high school, and it was always pretty like in fantasy worlds. And that's kind of where I liked to be. And yeah, in college, I studied engineering. And so I didn't write as much in college, but I kept wanting to take really English classes or humanities classes. But it's kind of, it was kind of hard with the engineering workload, but I managed to take some in my senior year when things lightened up a bit. And yeah, and then after college, I actually had way more time to write. I did have like a full-time engineering job, but it was much easier to manage compared to college for me. And so I would write at night and on the weekends, and yeah, mostly still in like the fantasy or sci-fi space.
That's interesting, because your debut book, The Phoenix Pencil Company, is, you know, mostly a historical novel, and it obviously has magic in it. It is magical realism. It's not fantasy with a capital F, but mm-hmm. Yeah, that is like so different from what you usually wrote. So where did the idea for Marvin, you're about to interrupt me, so what's up?
Oh no, I was just curious, because we get a lot, like, you know, you're not the only Books and Boba author who got their start writing fan fiction. So, you know, if you're okay with sharing, I'm super curious what your fandom was that you wrote stories for.
Oh, yeah. It was Harry Potter, which, you know, no one likes J.K. Rowling now, which is for good reasons. But yeah, that's kind of, it was like extremely prevalent when I was in the fan fiction community. And that's, but yeah, I also read like, I had like a phase reading Prince of Tennis fan fiction. Like the
anime. I love Prince of Tennis. It is like one of my
favorite
anime
and
mangas of all time.
You have good taste. So yeah, I was reading like quite a bit, but I only wrote for Harry Potter.
Yeah.
I mean, the best thing about Harry Potter is its fandom and how creative its fans have been in just like the arts. And it's unfortunate that that our childhood is somewhat tainted,
right,
now.
Yeah.
But I mean, like with fan fiction, I couldn't help but like wonder if you were a Tumblr girly back in the day, because like you're you have two main characters who like write stories, and they like write stories together, send chapters back and forth in a way. And I was like, oh, that's very fanficy. It's very like Tumblr-esque. So I was like,
yeah,
I wasn't sure if I should ask you.
I was like, that's right. Yeah, no, I was definitely on Tumblr. Like, probably from like late high school or college. I wasn't like that active. I forget what it's called.
Retumbling, yeah.
I did a lot of that. I didn't like post any of my own stuff much. But the stories was I think more based in fan fiction, where like my cousin and I would each write fan fiction. We would like send it to each other, and for not really critique, just to have each other's stories.
Yeah. I think it's very a girlhood canon, you know. And like, well, we'll mention Embers later on in the chat, but it did kind of remind me of like what I was like, oh, is this like the tech bro version of of Tumblr's journaling, you know, back in the day?
Yeah,
when
yeah, totally
people used
be.
To like be very personal on mm-hmm, Tumblr
yeah,
and
very
social
vulnerable.
Media. Yeah.
Mm-hmm,
yeah. So where did the idea for the Phoenix Pencil Company first germinate from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it came from, I was reading this book called The Last Boat Out of Shanghai, which is a nonfiction book that follows four people who leave Shanghai during the 1940s to the 60s for various reasons, mostly war or cultural revolution reasons. And I found it very illuminating. It wasn't like a period of history that I knew all that much about, even though it was what my grandparents went through. And I just felt like I wanted to know more. And it kind of made me think about that period more. Like you mentioned, I was not writing anything historical or remotely historical. I wasn't even reading that much historical, but yeah, that that made me really curious about that time period. And then my grandparents did run a pencil company before they left China, and then they brought it to, or they branched out. They had a branch in Taiwan, which was actually why they went to Taiwan. And so that was kind of the seed of like, okay, I want to explore this family that is living. I chose the international settlement of Shanghai because that's where a lot of the stories in Last Boat Out of Shanghai were took place. And they run a pencil company, and kind of it went from there.
Yeah. What I really liked about your story was it managed to articulate something that I find myself having a hard time articulating sometimes, which is like the complicated histories of like our grandparents' generation and the fact that like, yeah, like they had to deal with war and then war and then war again, right? Mm-hmm. And then after that war, they had to deal with like martial law and all this other like just a lot of hardship, a lot of just really bad times. Mm-hmm. And growing up in the States as like, you know, in a more stable environment, we don't really think about that, right? And that's by design. Like our grandparents don't want us to think about that, but then it's still part of the story. And so as someone who also has like, you know, heritage from China to Taiwan to the States, I was like, I really did relate to, you know, your main character, Monica's own personal journey in covering her grandmother's stories and histories through her family's powers of reforging and all that. So,
oh, I'm so glad. Thank you for sharing that.
So like, I know that you were a 2023 Reese's Book Club Lit Up Fellowship writer. So can you just tell us a little bit about your experience there? And also just like, what was it like receiving like editorial support through this fellowship?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so it's a super unique fellowship in that, well, one, it's run by Reese's Book Club, and they have kind of a huge say in the book, in the publishing industry. So I was in the second year that they've done it. So it's only been around for 3 years now. Or not 3 years, three cycles. They don't do it quite every year. It's like a little more than a year. But yeah, so it was, I just kind of applied for it. I think a lot of writers will probably say that they just apply for things and see what sticks, because most often it doesn't stick and you get like tons of rejections. So I just applied for it. And yeah, miraculously I got it. And it was me and four other people, who I've become like very, very good friends with. And we all got paired with a Reese's Book Club author. So I was paired with Adrienne Young, whose, book Fable had been picked for Reese's Book Club a few years back. And yeah, she was also writing, I guess Fable was more fantasy, well, a lot more. This is like a secondary world fantasy, but more of her recent stuff has been more set in like our world, so a little more similar in terms of magical stakes to what I was working on. And yeah, I think at that stage, so this, you had to not be agented when that was one of the requirements for applying to the fellowship. So at that stage, being able to get feedback from like an author as established as Adrienne, who already had like many books out, both in YA and adult, was, I don't know, really remarkable. I think there's not that many opportunities to actually get feedback on like your entire manuscript from somebody so seasoned. And yeah, so she told me like what she thought was like really, really working and also what could be, you know, we had like a lot of good talks, and the fellowship brought us all together in Nashville. So we got to like hang out there and walk around and just talk about not only the book, but also like the publishing journey in general, which I think is another thing that it's like a little opaque, and but to be able to talk about it with somebody, and not just her, but like the other Reese's Book Club mentors were there too. And we would have lunch and they would all just be like chatting and talking shop, and it was just really cool to be able to witness that.
Yeah, it sounds like a really special experience for someone who, you know, wasn't agented at the time, and like later on, like just getting professional feedback from someone who is so seasoned in the field. It is a gift, because quite frankly, writing is such a solitary activity. And so, like, what is the story with you and Fonda Lee? Because I, like, Because I could have sworn that Fonda Lee like was a mentor during this time, or I don't know where I read this, but yeah, please tell me how you two connected.
Oh yeah, well, I am a big Fonda Lee fan, and
she's a friend of the show too. So
great. I mean, I was a big fan, and then I applied to this workshop in Aspen. So it was through like Aspen Summer Words, and it was their first year where they had a sci-fi fantasy track. And she was the inaugural teacher for that. And so I applied and I got it. And that was another moment of like, wow, I can't believe I got this. I'm so excited to meet Fonda Lee. And yeah, so then that's how I met her. She was the head of our workshop of, I don't know, maybe like 12 people or so. And we were just in Aspen for a week. And we were, I think I brought a short story there. And the short story was actually a short story version of this book. I had been working on the book at the time, but it started as a short story of just the historical parts. Much condensed. Yeah. So it was like 5,000 words, but I found that it wasn't, like, it was working, but not in the way that I wanted it to be working, I think.
Well, I can't imagine this book like just being a short story. Like, there's just so much that goes into it. I mean, there's like multiple timelines, and you know, it's to have expanded it into a novel. That's quite a feat. But the reason why I brought up Fonda is because when I think about the rules of magic and world building, when it comes to like tangible magic, Fonda is like the first person who comes to mind. Our listeners will know that she's like the author of the Green Bone Saga, and the way she is able to just like build a society around just like this one magical trait that a family possesses, like it's quite incredible. And I thought, you know, wow, like the magic in your book, Reforging, was so unique. So like to our listeners who have not read the book yet, what is Reforging, and what was the inspiration behind it, and just like how did you come up with the rules on how Reforging works?
So Reforging is something that the characters, the family in this story, can do, and they are pencil makers, and they can take a pencil, and it's a little gruesome, but they like stab it into their wrists, and then their blood absorbs the graphite of the pencil. And then if they let the blood out, then it forms the words that the pencil once wrote before, or drawings, or whatever the pencil once wrote before. And in that way, they can kind of revive the stories that that the pencils had written before. I think I'm not quite sure exactly how the idea came to me, except that I knew I wanted to write about pencil makers, and I was coming from a fantasy background. And so I wanted there to be something fantastical about the pencils they were making. And I think one of the most powerful things that a pencil can do is to write stories. And so I wanted to go to kind of extract that in some way and use that to, fuel the fantasy portion of the book. There had been another aspect. In Jade City, the jade can do all, it lends them like a few powers. I forget how many, but it is confined, and it's not like, it's like pretty strict. And then I wasn't like thinking in parallel to jade magic at the time, but I thought, okay, they will be able to do this, and they will also be able to. And the other idea I had was that if they stabbed the pencil in, they could get like an armored hand of graphite, and it would be like really hard and strong, and they could, I don't know, punch through walls with it or something. And that was in the first few drafts before my beta readers told me that it didn't seem like quite the right book to have like super strong pencil arms. And so that got that got cut, but it's kind of in the story in that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I do like that you still incorporated somehow, like, screw your readers, I'm going to put it in your face.
Yeah, because I thought it was a fun idea, and so it is incorporated because the characters write this fantasy versions of themselves that have this power, and that's kind of how they get through the war, really, is by crafting these stories where they are more powerful than they are.
Yeah, Rira, when you brought up Fauna Lee and Jade City, it got me thinking about like what I liked a lot about the world building that Fauna did in that book series was that, you know, Jade is like her conduit for the book's magical powers, but it's also like a practical tool and a natural resource that becomes like the center of political and economic power for her setting with like real world consequences of that power. And in the same way, Alice, in your book, the act of reforging, the power to reforge pencils is also like instrumentalized as a tool for practical use. You know, first it was used as a way to pass secret messages in the fight against the Japanese invaders. But after the war, it becomes a tool for essentially like a police state, right? It becomes a surveillance tool. And something that I keyed in on is the fact that like this power is only possessed by the female members of this one family and involves not a small amount of both bleeding and emotional labor. Like, I feel like as a guy, right, I can understand in theory what the metaphor here is, but I imagine you know, our female readers will probably be able to get a lot more nuance out of it. And your book does go into like a lot of detail into like the, it's a very complicated process to be able to reforge a pencil. So I'm really curious how, you know, what went into your thought process for how reforging works.
Yeah, so as you alluded to, there used to be even more steps and it was like pretty tied to the menstrual cycle. But that kind of got cut during the editorial phase for various reasons. I think there is this. So I think this book straddles a few genre lines and I was coming at it from a fantasy angle and I wanted everything like spelled out and to make sense in a way, the way that the jade magic makes sense in Greenbone Saga. But then my editor wanted it to be more, and I think she's right in this case, of that it's kind of a case where the reader doesn't need to know like all of the details of the magic. Like, it's not the kind of book that, it's not like a Brandon Sanderson kind of thing where you want to know like the rules of the magic. Like, you want to know the vague rules and that there are limits, but you don't need to know like how it works with the menstrual cycle or anything like that. So even though I thought it was cool and it didn't really need to be there. And I think my editor had said like, I think you can get away with like hand waving some of the magic and like stop hand waving some of the historical parts. So I had to like go back and beef up a lot of the historical parts because, as I mentioned, I was never like a historical writer or anything.
Let's get into that. Like what, like how did you go about like the historical research for the book? Because like you said, there's not a lot of hand waving you can do about history, especially something as like as documented as like the Cultural Revolution, and like, of course, also just
the White Terror.
That was definitely the hardest part for me by far, in terms both in terms of the amount of work I had to do and also in terms of like my, I don't know if it's like my attitude towards it, but I was. And I talked to Fonda about this too. I kind of like had a breakdown in front of her where I was like, I don't know if I can write like this historical parts and like do justice to this like really awful time period, and what kind of like what right do I have to write it? And she was very encouraging and nice about it. But yeah, I think it was very intimidating. And also because I can read Chinese, but it's very, very difficult for me and it takes me an extremely long time. So primary sources weren't really an option, unless I like translated it with Google or something, which sometimes I did, but that's still not great. So I mean, as I mentioned, I started with The Last Boat Out of Shanghai, which gave me the like basically the beats I had to hit, like when each war starts and when significant battles are, when Shanghai is occupied, when people would be leaving for Taiwan. And then from there, it was mostly just reading whatever memoirs or other historical books I could find of the era, but in English. So that already limits the search.
I am curious, like, was the modern day stuff in like the original like grand plan? Because, you know, like it could have easily been like a historical novel based on like these two girls who mm-hmm. are trying to like survive occupation after occupation. But you have like Monica's story weaved into it as well, and I thought it was really interesting because you know, the power of reforging, the power of being able to reproduce words that people wrote with a pencil, and also be able to understand the writer's original intent, like that's mm-hmm. like super valuable. But in the era of tech, where like data is everywhere and just you can really find out things about someone just from doing a couple of like keystrokes. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was like a really interesting parallel to like how surveillance works today versus like back in like the 1940s. So mm-hmm. yeah, like did you always have the modern day chapters early on?
Yeah, they came pretty early. I mean, certainly not the earliest. Like I mentioned, the short story only had the historical sections. And then that's when I kind of had my breakdown of like, can I write this? And so the modern part was actually kind of a way to make me feel a little better about that aspect, where I was like, okay, I know this character. I know, like, she has very similar traits to me. So like everywhere that she goes in the book is somewhere I have lived before, pretty much. And I thought, okay, if I can write half of this book as a character who I know really well, I know the places, I know like the problems, the tech she's dealing with super well, then that would make me feel better about writing this history that I didn't know that much about and didn't feel like ownership over, I guess. And so that was part of it. And then the other part, like very early on, I had this note, like as I was writing, like my thoughts of what this book could be. I had like 1940s pencil company, magical pencils. I had like menstrual magic, and then I had like data privacy ? So that was always going to be like the tie-in for the modern part of and I think, and also because to me, as somebody who like grew up with my grandparents and did wonder about their stories, I think that was the part that if I were reading the book, would that I wanted to resonate the most, in that it's about a granddaughter trying to know her grandmother's story. And that's the part that I felt like I could write and that I would be able to do justice to.
Yeah. I mean, like, what was that like though, to write a character that was so, that shared such close personal experiences as you? I mean, like Monica, a software engineer, mm-hmm. also has like a very close relationship with her grandmother. And, you know, like how did writing her story help you reframe your own journey mm-hmm. as an Asian American?
Mm-hmm. I do think writing this book was a lot about processing my relationship with my grandmother, who did have Alzheimer's as well. And I think that's something that I've always been kind of circling around, like writing about memory and what happens when memory fades. And because that was something that I saw very viscerally growing up. And then on top of that, the historical parts. And I think one of the themes of the book is that, like, yes, it matters. Like stories matter, but the other part is like who receives the stories matters as well. And who owns the, or who, I mean, quote unquote owns, no one really owns a story, but who has the right to tell a story, I guess. And I think part of it was an acceptance of my part that I am never going to know my grandparents' stories. Like they passed away many years ago. And even before that, my grandmother had been losing her memories. And so I will never really know what they lived through, but I can try to empathize. And sometimes that's the best we can do. So a lot of the book was like me coming to terms with that as well.
Yeah. Your book is entirely written in like epistolary format. It's either like the chapters are either handwritten journal entries or reforged letters or typed up posts on embers. And I thought that was just like a really interesting way to unravel the mystery of like, oh, like what happened to this family that owned like a pencil company. How did they get all the way over here? Because people are unreliable narrators, and there's a lot of like secrets that that people hide from each other. So I was just like wondering, what were the challenges and benefits of writing your novel in like this format where people are kind of being dodgy as they write their own journal entries and are not being like so forthcoming with you know their own sharing, even though like for example for Embers it promotes like radical sharing. They're like, yeah, like be as vulnerable as you want and so we'll like connect you to other people out there, but your privacy is totally like our like priority. And it's like, okay.
Yeah. I think epistolary is great in many ways. I think there are actually many more benefits than struggles. So, I mean, a struggle is that you have to get the reader to believe that this is something that somebody would write down in a journal or in a letter. But the trick there is you kind of frame the beginning and the end as like, I'm writing blah blah blah, and then you can flow into like kind of normal storytelling, and normally people are okay with it, or hopefully people are okay with it. And so that was always a challenge. And the other thing is that the point of view from the grandmother, she's writing to her cousin, so it's almost second person. And that's another challenge of like, why would this person be describing the house that they both lived in when they were younger? Like the other person would know that already. So that was another thing that I had to strike a balance for. But there's actually a lot of pros in that. I think you can be a bit more hand wavy about certain things, especially historical parts. Like this person wouldn't be describing like exactly like the architecture of these city streets to this other person who also lived there. And you still have to do the work of a lot of the historical parts, but you can get away with some of those details that you might feel pressured to put in a traditional, I don't know, third person story. So yeah, I think I always knew that the grandmother's story at least would be written in the form of letters to her cousin, because I think a lot of the book is about how you share your own story or how you frame it too. And I wanted that to come across in the device of how the book is sharing its story as well. Monica's, I was back and forth a bit about if hers had to be a journal as well. And I really wanted it to be for that same reason of she's also framing her own story. But it was a struggle at times. Like I had to, because I had to really figure out how Embers worked before I could really make it somewhat convincing that she would be writing in this or in a journal, but not necessarily on Embers.
Yeah. I'm just going back and thinking just about how many levels you're working on here in terms of like a story about a story about people writing stories.
Yeah, that was a good time.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned like a recurring theme is like, oh, who gets to like tell our story? Who gets to, you know, quote unquote, own our stories? But, you know, ownership is like a weird concept when it comes to stories and memories. Monica meets another Chinese American girl, Louise, and she is also doing some kind of archival project. And I just thought it was interesting because both of them are coming from such a, like, they're so starved for connection, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I'm just like wondering, like, how did you go about building their relationship? Because it's also on top of this being a magical realism historical fiction novel, there's also a love story involved in it, and it's queer. So how did you develop Louise and Monica's story from like their meet cute on Embers to you know, having this wholesome relationship with you know, them and Monica's grandmother, who is losing her memories?
Yeah, I think writing their relationship was a lot of fun for me, and was kind of an offset to all of the war I had to write about as well. And so I knew I wanted Monica to also have like a significant relationship, because the grandmother has a significant relationship with her cousin, and that's kind of the tension between those two characters is kind of what drives the plot of the historical section. So Monica also needed somebody to be her foil. And also because Monica doesn't do that much in the book, she's kind of in a very stagnant place in her life. And she's chosen to stay home for the semester to take care of her grandparents. And so she's kind of watching like the lives of her friends in college go by, and she's just kind of at home. And you know, and she wants to be there. She wants to be there for her grandparents, but it's still hard for her. And so she meets Louise, and Louise is very outgoing and friendly.
And tall.
She's very tall. Yes, that's her main characteristic. And she was an aspiring archivist. So somebody who is very interested in stories, and in particular, she's very interested in the stories of people like Monica's grandmother. So people who have lived through these wars in China and who are dying or who are losing their memories now in the modern, or in the book that part's set in 2018. But and so she and Monica developed this relationship that is kind of, that starts with out of like a, both of them being interested in this time period and stories from that time, but then grows into something that is more about, as you mentioned, like they're both craving like connection. And in Louise's case, she doesn't know like her grandparents, and she wants to know more about that history. And in Monica's case, she's kind of just a lonely person, and she's, you know, she's home alone outside of her grandparents. And but the best parts were being able to write like the scenes of Monica and Louise and Monica's grandparents together. And I think that was a really fun way for me to highlight like the grandparents' love for Monica that would extend to Louise in ways that are kind of fun and hopefully resonate with some people. Like, I think I've heard other people say that Monica's grandparents keep remarking on how tall Louise is as being like kind of something funny that their family would
do. I have to say, like, one of my favorite, I think this is like such a random thing to be just like attached to, but I love the volleyball game in the book where, like, you know, Louise, like she goes to Princeton and she's, you know, playing volleyball, and they're playing against Harvard. And obviously it's, you know, it, like, they're playing on Harvard's turf, right? So there's not that many people cheering for Louise's team. And I just thought it was so endearing that it was like Monica and her grandparents are there with like their handmade banners, and they're like, yay, like, Monica's tall girlfriend, go you.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah, the volleyball scene's one of my favorite scenes. And I'm guessing if you like Prince of Tennis, you might also be a hockey fan. Yeah, that's where that came from.
Prince of Tennis walked so that Haikyuu could run. for those of you guys who are into sports animes.
Yeah. Yeah. I really did enjoy their relationship too. And especially like you mentioned, their different like internal relationships to their history, their culture. And it really, like, I feel like your book is just such a, it's just a really good, like, Asian American story, right? Because a lot of us, like I mentioned, like a lot of us really don't know. Like I know about my grandparents' story, but only through like the lens of like my dad telling me about it, right? But they never really told me anything about what they did or what happened during, you know, during the 40s and 50s. And I think it's just such a lot of us are either a Luis who are searching out for those stories and like crave, like, I need to know where I come from, or like a Monica who's just like, you know, I care about my family, but like also a little bit afraid of what if what I learn will change how I feel about them. Right.
Yeah. No, I really appreciate you saying that, because I think I definitely find a bit of myself in both of them too.
Yeah. So I guess as we head towards the end of our conversation, you know, congratulations on your debut. How has it been like having the book out in the world and having people read it?
It's been good. Yeah. So far, I mean, I try not to read any reviews or anything. Unless
I think that's a
like,
wise way to go about life.
Yeah. Unless someone like tags me in something, then I'll read it. But yeah, otherwise, but I think some people have like, I think people seem to be very drawn to the historical sections as something that was a part of history they never knew about. And people actually, yeah, tend to be more drawn to the grandmother's chapters than Monica's. And I get that Monica doesn't do all that much, but I really like Monica's chapters. And I think actually the people I've gotten some reviews of people who are currently caring for somebody with dementia or Alzheimer's and Monica's chapters have resonated with them a lot more. And that really means a lot. And I feel like that's all I can really ask for.
Yeah. Okay. We can't let you go without asking this really annoying question, but
oh, okay.
what else are you working on anything else right now, or are you just enjoying the book being out there?
Yeah, I'm trying to work on something else. It's kind of slow going, but it's going. And I think it's going to be about the exciting world of semiconductors, which
more communication. Yeah,
very
more
timely though, because yeah. That is, you know, semiconductors make the world go round.
Yeah, it's true, and I think it's a very like. Story. It's a story that's, I think, rooted in Taiwanese history too, and that's kind of the part I'm interested in exploring.
Yeah. Well, Allison, it's a wonderful book, and we're so glad to have you on the show to talk about it. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us on Books and Boba, and you know, good luck on your next year and future endeavors.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for all the thoughtful questions, and I feel like you all read the book very carefully and really understood it. So thank you.
And that was Allison King. Her debut novel, The Phoenix Pencil Company, is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Boba online bookstore. So if you enjoyed our conversation and want to check out her book, head on over to booksandboba.com and check out our online bookstore. Any purchases made there will support not only us at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstore. So I definitely appreciate everyone who's bought a book from us there so far. All right. Well, before we go, Vera, can you remind our listeners what book we are reading for book club this month?
Yeah, so we are reading Pingsu for Two by Sujin Witherspoon, and this is a Honey Boba patron's pick, and it is perfect for summer because Pingsu is shaved ice, for those of you who are unfamiliar. It's like a very snowy texture with... you know, usually flavored with condensed milk, red bean, and fresh fruits. Very, very summery treat. And I'm sure that this book will also be a summery treat for us because, wow, the world is on fire and we could really use some light time readings. But this is an adorable enemies to lovers coffee shop romance. And I've heard that it's a pretty good read for those who are fans of like Jenny Han's like To All the Boys I've Loved Before, so that is kind of like the feels we're going for this month. So if you guys want to read along with us and share your thoughts, make sure to share on our Discord or our Goodreads forums.
Yeah, as always, we love to include your feedback whenever possible in our end of month book club discussion. So definitely looking forward to hearing your thoughts about this book as well. But with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Allison King for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, Sharon.
Hey, Remen.
How are folks still racist?
I know, right? We're like 2 decades into the 21st century.
Yeah, and second question, where's my jetpack?
Well, I can't help you there, but have I got a podcast for you. Modern Minorities is a show where each week my longtime pal Remen and I uncover common and uncommon truths that we all need to hear for our majority brains and ears.
Yeah, Sharon and I have spoken to doctors, lawyers, directors, climate activists, angry Asians, athletes, chefs, writers.
Folks who are Black, brown, gay, straight, and everything in between.
Past guests have included comedian Margaret Cho, Southern Poverty Law Center journalist Geraldine Mariba, comics creator Jean Lun Yang, and many, many more.
We've even talked about Ramadan, Black History Month, Kamala Khan, and Robin being queer.
It's like we're trying to solve racism with the podcast.
Challenge accepted.
So check out Modern Minorities at modmypod.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Remember, we're all modern minorities, but we're no one's model minority.